Nasser Rabat, Aga Khan Professor of Architecture at MIT, a Damascene from way back. For us, Nasser Rabat, the question is, what will we say happened to Syria in front of our eyes? But for Americans, there's also this question of, was non-intervention as damaging in the end as American interventions have been? And now you write this marvelous account of your father's death last year, about 90, a man who lived through most of the 20th century and a great deal of Syria's national history. And you make it a marvelous combination of man and nation. I'd love you just to tell us that story.
Thank you. Let me start actually by saying something that is not part of the story, perhaps to set, if you want, the environment a little bit. And that is what I remember the most about my father, who, as a matter of fact, believed in Syria, but also believed in an Arab nation. He grew up at a time in which the youth of Syria believed that Syria is the heart of the future Arab nation, but then suffered tremendously from the fact that the country fell into a bloody, brutal dictatorship for the last 60 years, ever since the Ba'ath Party took over. So when my father was in the syndicate of lawyers in Damascus, he had the permit to go with his car to Lebanon, which actually was not very easy for a lot of Syrians. This is in the late 60s and early 70s. And I remember as kids, he would take us in his huge American Pontiac of 1959, and we would be sitting in the back, my sister, myself, and my grandmother, who is Lebanese, and my mom, and we will cross the border. And my dad, as we cross the border, opens the window, even if it's snowing and it's cold outside, and he will ask us all to open the window. And as we open the window, my dad would say, "Smell freedom."
Oh my word.
For him, it was sort of like we are now crossing into where we could be freer than what Syria represented. This stuck in my mind. This actually is something that came back to my mind when my dad died. I didn't feel sadness until I took the plane back from Lebanon. He died and was buried in Lebanon, where my family is now. And on the plane, I actually put on some music and I listened to Pink Floyd and I listened to I'm Comfortably Numb. And this is when I remembered my dad and I started crying. And I took out my laptop and started writing what ultimately became this little piece. And by the time I landed in Logan, the piece was finished. So I rewrote it with the intention of presenting the history of Syria through the life of my dad, who was born in 1924. So 1924 is 4 years after Syria was occupied by France and 5 years after Syria came into being as a country, because Syria, having been part of the Ottoman Empire, claimed an independent Syria in 1918. And in 1919, it was declared to be the Kingdom of Syria, with the person who will ultimately become the king of Iraq and who is the older brother of the person who became the king of Jordan, and the most active son of the sheriff of Mecca, who started the Arab revolution against the Ottoman Turks, and who was aided by Lawrence of Arabia and made famous in the West because of the story of Lawrence of Arabia. King Faisal was the first king of Syria. The French removed him in 1920 as they occupied Damascus, after actually a fierce resistance of the nascent Syrian army, which we still celebrate until today, because it was in an area outside of Damascus that the final battle happened. So my dad is born into a colonial era, a country that is now under colonial authorities. And he grew up thinking that the first thing that we need to do is to get rid of the colonial forces, the colonial authorities. A son of a bourgeois family with a well-to-do background, and went to school, was an extremely active, very athletic individual, as a matter of fact, actually a bully for all intents and purpose. And he basically was a leader of these revolts against the French. And he grew up thinking of himself as actually a nationalist. He actually even thought of volunteering to join the Syrian army. But he thought about it a bit better and decided that, because Syria became independent around the time he was finishing high school. So by the time he got into college, he went to law school, because the model that was and still is the most widespread around the democratic world is that if you want to work in politics, you get yourself a law degree. So this is what he wanted to do. So he went with the notion that he's going to be a politician, but with a law degree. His father, a capitalist of sort, didn't like that, wanted him to go into commerce. But he did become a lawyer. And at the same time, Palestine happened. And at the same time, the Arabs, the majority of the Arabs, the masses of the Arabs are totally dismayed at the fact that the world is now giving half of Palestine to a Jewish state, and that no one is caring about what would happen to the Palestinians living there. So my father and a lot of his young colleagues from college, but actually friends from before, and they had a name for themselves. It's quite interesting. They used to all have crew cuts. So they called themselves in Arabic al-Mahaliq, basically the crew cut gang. Mm. And they were all sort of like really extremely impressive individuals, not too politicized. They are actually politicized at the level of understanding rights and duties.
Nasser Rabat, you were born in 1956 and named Nasser. There's a lot of the story is right there. Nasser, the president of Egypt, the closest thing to a real big-time pan-Arabic leader that the Arab nation has had. Unpack that moment and the hopes and the beliefs and the visions that were contained in that name.
I was 4 years old when Abdel Nasser gave a speech in Damascus after having become now the president of the United Arab Republic, that was Syria and Egypt. And I can tell you that there was perhaps 500,000 people in there. And this is when Damascus had perhaps 600,000 individuals in it. I mean, his appeal was just unbelievable. Everyone in Syria was hoping that this is going to be the beginning of the creation of a united Arab nation. And Abdel Nasser presented that hope because he was such a charismatic person, not because he was in strategically intelligent or any of that stuff. It was his charisma that was carrying him. And the Syrians, if you read the history of the region at the time, of course, were disappointed at the major defeat in 1948 and the Arab armies defeated and Israel expanding into land that was initially given to the Palestinian side in the partition rule in the United Nations. So all over in actually Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Egypt, Sudan, Iraq, and so on, were all yearning for some sort of a new unified Arab state that is going to redress the wrong that had befallen the Arabs through the colonial power and ultimately through the creation of Israel and the defeat at the hand of this nascent nation. So Abdel Nasser was the hero that is not to be questioned the first year or two in the Union. But then Abdel Nasser actually was like almost all imperial powers. He was basically pursuing his own imperial dreams and thought of Syria more or less as sort of like the first colony. So most of the Syrian wealth was transferred to Egypt. A lot of Egyptian apparatchiks were appointed in high positions in Syria. The Syrians started feeling that they were being colonized by the Egyptians. So within 3 years, the Syrians, I would say at least the educated Syrians, all have turned against the Union. And actually, my mom and dad are very good example. They worked underground and they supported the notion of the creation of a United Arab Republic in 1958. We're talking about 1956 to 1958. There was a huge movement in Syria. And in 1961, even though my parents will deny it, but I can say it now, it's too far back in time, our home was actually one of the cells for the underground movement that was organizing the secession against Egypt, which was led by mostly Damascene bourgeois. And I remember these people coming and meeting in our house. So Abdel Nasser lost a lot of his political capital, if you want, in Syria during those 3 years, but not totally. I mean, the dream of an Arab united republic of sorts lived on. It wasn't destroyed until, I would say, 1967, the defeat of 1967.
I was going to say, Abdel Nasser, 1960, may have been bad, but he was a bargain. He was a figure of great glory compared to what came next. I mean, take us through, you know, in whatever steps you think are important, the decline from then, as your father would have experienced it and suffered it.
In Syria, at least, it could be seen through the rise and ultimate fall of the Ba'ath Party, which came into power in 1963. So Syria was actually an independent parliamentary bourgeois-led country between 61 and 63, between the breakup of the Union with Abdel Nasser and with Egypt and the Ba'ath Party take over. Now, the Ba'ath Party is a party that came also with a very pan-Arabist mission, a bit secular, established by a Christian intellectual with few Muslim intellectuals and other minorities around him, was a secular party absolutely at the beginning. But they realized, as they were dabbling in politics in the 1950s, throughout the 1950s, they were running for office in Syria and so on, they realized that they have very little chance of coming to power through elections. So they turned around and they said, let's actually pursue the military option. So it was a military coup in 1963 that ultimately brought the Ba'ath Party to power. Initially, it was actually a coalition of different political forces. And once the Ba'ath Party was in power in Syria, they somehow showed their ugly side, which is basically that they were going to impose themselves as the only political power in the country. This is when my father was probably at the height of his political involvement and thinking that there is still room for some sort of a democratic process. So he and a number of lawyers used to meet every Wednesday evening and debate public issues, and they would actually send letters to people in power. They had most of the people in power, as a matter of fact, they were their friends, and they were somewhat involved as a block of legal individuals that are somehow taking part in the affairs of the country. So the Ba'ath Party at the beginning tolerated that, but by 65, it was the hardline ideologue who were mostly of minorities and mostly of Alawi background that have taken over in Syria and are now sort of like in most of the sensitive positions. This is when the government showed, or the regime showed, its absolutist tendency. And this is where all political opposition was banned, and those who were caught were actually imprisoned with no trial, tortured, a lot of them were killed. A lot of them, we're talking about, I mean, small numbers. We're talking about sort of like dozens of people that died in prisons in the 1960s. But the government managed to impose a rule of fear, a rule of horror, that the people are afraid of the government. This is how I grew up. Now, here I am, 7 or 8 years old, and I remember that my dad would talk about how he feels about the government at home. But then every day before I leave to school, my mom would remind me, do not say anything that you heard at home in the school, because everything might be reported, and your dad might end up in prison. Even though my dad by that time was not political, but he was just basically expressing his dissatisfaction with the way the government was handling the country. So we really lived in an age of horror in the 1960s. And even though the oppression and the killing was not as widespread as it happened later on under the Assad's père et fils, but it was still an age of horror. And it was an age of horror because it came actually after an age of a relative openness. So we weren't used to it. When Assad took over in 1970, the establishment of a sectarian security-based regime was already in place. He just reinforced it. He's not the one that actually invented it. And what made it even more difficult is that that regime, that party, was defeated so spectacularly in 1967. And all the dreams of the liberation of Palestine and so on were shattered, because everyone was believing that, yes, indeed, actually, between Nasser's Egypt and Syria of the Ba'ath Party and the armies that have been built over the last 20 years and so on, Israel will be defeated in any confrontation. And of course, actually, Israel managed to defeat the three Arab countries, occupy the rest of historical Palestine, take over Sinai and the Golan Heights from Syria, and establish itself as the one and only superpower in the region. And all of the Arabs, not me, of course, I was a kid. I was like a 10-year-old kid at that time. But people who were of age at the time started realizing that all of these dreams of unity and power and progressive movements, because, of course, all of these governments were trying to claim to be socialist, all of that was destroyed in a six-day war. I would actually say, I would submit that the Arabs across the republics of the Arab world, so Egypt, Syria, Iraq, probably Yemen, Sudan and so on, these are actually a defeated generation. And you could see it in their production, in their cultural production. If you see the films, the songs, the books, the historical works of the time, they are all reflecting amazing pessimism and a sense of defeat, a sense of trauma. I would actually even submit that the Arabs have not really managed to come out of it, despite having portrayed the war of 1973 as a relative victory over Israel, even though we know that it was probably a stalemate at the end of the war. In 1973, neither side won or lost.
Let me ask, for 40 years plus, the world has seen Syria as a mafia state, basically. How did the state justify it, and why did not the Syrians rebel?
So the Syrians did not revolt, in a sense, because they were afraid. But they also revolted. That is, in 1976, there was a revolt. In 1982, the suppression was tremendous. The world chose not to focus on it. It's actually amazing that a city was semi-destroyed, at least one quarter of the population was killed in 3 days of the National Army attacking the city, and it was not reported anywhere. I think actually the New York Times reported it like in page 17. It was not covered. And the government very quickly rebuilt the area or cordoned it off. And you can't go into the old neighborhood. But those of us who are historians of architecture like myself know how much was lost, because Hama was a town that became a major center at the time of the Crusaders, at the time of Saladin, and his family built palaces there. A lot of those were destroyed during that rebellion of 1982. So it's not that the Syrians did not revolt. They did revolt, but the ruler was ruthless and amazingly intelligent in terms of security and intelligence. He used all the tools in his hand, the sectarian loyalty and the tribal loyalty and the family loyalty, bribing people in power. I know that everyone in power in Syria has become a rich person. Hafez Assad created this core of regime supporters who controlled the 9 branches of intelligence that he has established, so that actually they can't plot against him because they all report back to him. And they were all members of his tribe. Every single head of these security apparatuses. Now there's one who is not member of the tribe among these 9, who is actually a Sunni Muslim, and the others are all Alawi. That's one side. And the other side is to keep the bourgeoisie happy through sort of like allowing it to maintain some sort of mercantile or free mercantile activities as long as they stayed away from politics. But it was an oppressive regime all along, and that's why the people did not revolt. The other reason, which actually a historian would tell you and probably is important, is that Syria is a relatively young country. I mean, the notion of Syrianness, the notion of nationalism, the notion of citizenship, all of these are very new to the Syrian. That's why perhaps we see the Syrian opposition today in disarray and not being able to join forces, not being able to produce a real political discourse that reflects who they are, what they stand for, how they want the country to become in the future. We are an inexperienced, or we were an inexperienced people, in terms of being a people, being a nation. And now, of course, actually, that has been even further destroyed. So reconstituting a notion of Syrianness, of belonging, is not going to be easy.
What did your father share with you about what he was going through? Here he is, a lawyer, in his heart an oppositionist, but he has access to the dictator. What was happening to his idea of Syria?
It was being shattered. This is, in a sense, when that notion of sort of like you smell freedom in Lebanon that I started with comes into the story. This is when he basically had given up on the Syria that he had hoped for, because he had witnessed Syria becoming an independent country in 1946, and he was hoping for a progressive, democratic, parliamentarian Syria. 1980, Hafez Assad cracked down very hard on any expression of freedom. So he dissolved all the professional organizations and tied them to the Central Committee of the Baath Party. And now you appoint the representative of the lawyer, the representative of the medical doctor, of the engineers, of the architects, or whatever it is, from the Baath Party. That's when my father, 1980, my father said, "This is it, I give up. Nothing is going to happen." And he basically retreated to becoming a family man. This is when he really had no longer any political or any public role, if you want, not even actually an advocacy role vis-a-vis the regime. So between 1980 and the time he died, my dad basically was a defeated individual. who represented a defeated generation of people that were hopeful that Syria would be a, I'll use the word again, progressive country of some sort, independent, free, and so on, democratic country. And they basically lived with their memories. Some of them are actually invented memories. That is, it's no longer just the memories of how Syria was or what it could be, but that's the invented memories that the Arabs are actually extremely good at doing. That is, living with the memories of the glory of the Arabs in the past, and 1,000 years ago and so on, because you sort of like are wallowing in the misery of the moment, so you look at the past as sort of like a source of some sort of a pride. So there is something, not necessarily in the figure of my father, he was really just a regular citizen, a lawyer, but in the notion of a Syrian generation that started with, for all intents and purposes, with the right aspirations for building a modern state, and ended defeated, and now I'm actually seeing it as also ended dying outside of the country.
So your father dies in exile in a fashion, almost 90 years old. The Assad family is still hanging on by its fingernails and by barrel bombs on Aleppo and elsewhere. What's his last word?
This is where it becomes a bit painful, because he actually was forced to stay in Lebanon. My dad was suffering from all sorts of ailments, and it's my mom and sister who were taking care of him. And he wanted to go back to Damascus and die in Damascus. He did not want to die away from Damascus. So my sister took away his passport so that he does not leave the village where they are in Lebanon and sneak into Syria. So that, how do I sum up his life? A cardiologist, a Lebanese cardiologist, was summoned to come and see him. My dad is sort of like half drugged, and he has IV in his hand and oxygen in his nose. And the doctor is saying, so what is paining you the most? Where do you feel pain? And he was sort of like checking him all over. And my dad, in a very, very soft voice, answered the question, Syria. Matter of fact, he said al-azma in Syria, which means the problem in Syria.
And paining you too, clearly.
What's paining me is the destruction of the country. You have to remember, I'm a historian of architecture. What's paining me is the destruction of the place and of the people that give the place its meaning. To me, Syria represents, historically at least, one of the very few places in the world until very, very recently where difference is tolerated at all levels. This is a country that has had, up until now, 18 different religions and sects that have lived together for hundreds of years. This is a country that was ruled by Muslims, and in many instances, actually, by Muslims who were extremely attached to their religion and felt that their religion is superior to anything else, and yet managed to maintain 15% of its population as Christian after 1,500 years of an Islamic rule. It's that kind of, not tolerance, actually. I'm not interested in the word tolerance. I am interested in the world of cohabitation, coexistence. It's that coexistence that represents the essence of Syria to me, more than anything else. And that's what's lost now. Its vestiges are lost. The people that represented are lost. And of course, actually, there's the human losses of the country. But to me, it's the crumbling of the idea of a country that historically was, in my opinion, actually, a model of how people can live together with differences. And it's no longer that. As a matter of fact, it's almost moving into a model of how people with differences cannot live together. And at the same time, actually, a country that was a very beautiful country, I should say.
Nasser Rabat, thank you for taking us so deep into your own thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's one man's half-hour history of the life and death of his father and his country over the last 90 years. Nasser Rabat is the Aga Khan Professor of Islamic Architecture at MIT. You'll find his many books and articles on the web. Mary McGrath produced and edited this podcast with Professor Rabat. The conversation isn't over until listeners, that's you, add a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.